For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. The show on the road again. Thought we were done with this. Thought we were back in the studio. Thought we were going to be spending, well, the rest of the year here in the home front. Nope. Decided we were going to hit the road. We're in Atlanta, Georgia. Going to cover the big runoff. December 6th, the big day. What's interesting here in Atlanta, in just the short period of time that I've been here, lots of people willing to share their thoughts on this, how important this race is and how important the attention of the country being focused here. And well, for some, they're kind of tired of it because this is another Senate runoff. You know, you had two of them the last election cycle. Now you've got this one, the eyes of the country again here in Georgia. And one of the things that's interesting that keeps coming back to is depending on who you talk to, the voting rule changes, how the Republicans have taken the opportunity to, well, do what they do best, and that is rig the game. Now, look, when you're in power, you're going to rig the game, and this isn't just Republicans who do this. Democrats have done it in the past, too. But right now, it's the Republicans in this state who have, well, rigged the whole game here. Because remember the last runoff just two short years ago? They had a 60-day window to run this runoff. Now they've made this much shorter, 30 days, which, again, doesn't sound like that bad of an idea. But when you figure that you're not going to be able to have, you know, new people be able to register to vote, the mail-in system, which evidently here, a lot of mail-in ballots, that going to take time. It's a lot, especially when they're moving locations around still. I've talked to a couple people who've had to go to the website to, you know, make sure that this is my polling location, only to find out, no, it's not. It makes me go, why do they make it so difficult to vote? Especially in high density urban areas. You know, some of the images that have been shown to me of people waiting to drop off their ballot, because we've cut down the number of drop boxes. You know, people waiting an hour to drop off their ballot in a box is insane to me. The way that things so far, and again, I keep coming back to, when you're in power, you want to stay in power and you rig the game to ensure that you stay in power. And rigging the game is ensuring that people don't get the vote, especially working class people who, look, I got schedules, got places to be. I can't wait an hour online just to drop off a ballot. I'll do it tomorrow. And they hope that tomorrow never comes. And this is one of those elections that, well, I mean, the decision for the Senate has already been made, but this is going to make for more opportunity. As one person reminded me, this is going to make Joe Manchin irrelevant. And it may. This is that kind of election. But more importantly, I see this as a heart and soul election. I see this as, do you believe in representation of someone who understands what it's like to be a working person, who understands the struggles, who actually will do the work, or someone who doesn't really even have a clue? I mean, the Georgia AFL-CIO put out this list of, you know, of talking points, and one of them is, you know, he'll be a vote for big money and for big business, and he will be. There's no question about that. That's an obvious true. But it got me down this rabbit hole of going, you know, he's not going to put the work in to actually investigate or do the kind of things that you would want a senator to do. He's not going to do his research. He's just going to be a rubber stamp. Whoever he's told to vote for, wherever he's told to stand, he's going to go there. Do you want someone, you know, and this is where I had a conversation at the hotel last night. Because, and I'll tell you about the long drive. Wow, our highways. Thanks, Joe Biden. No, seriously, I mean, lots of construction. Lots of orange barrels all the way here. But hey, you know, need the infrastructural improvements. Would like to see things expanded so less congestion. But yeah, it took me 14 hours to make an 11-hour trip. But that's a whole nother story. It got me into this moment where, you know, I'm talking to this guy in the hotel. And, you know, he's a conservative. What I would classify as a true conservative. You know, someone who is not just a lever puller, but understands the ideology and explained, you know, what it was about Walker that he found offensive. You know, honesty, consistency, you know, that kind of stuff. But as we were talking back and forth, you know, it came up that, you know, Warnock's a good guy. He's a good man, you know, doesn't agree with his policies, but doesn't question whether he's telling the truth or not. May not like the policies. And again, this is where I want the argument to be. This is where I want the discussion to be on whether policies are good or bad, or the directions that leaders want to take us are going to help us or make things worse. He couldn't say a positive thing about Herschel Walker. There's nothing, there's no record. And even the things that he was running on as a business owner, I guess, you know, largest, I don't know. I don't even know what the lie was, but, you know, created this giant business that didn't exist, you know, valedictorian of a class that he never graduated from, you know, whatever. And he was going through, you know, you want somebody in those offices. And look, this is where we ended up having this conversation about, you know, the right and the left and that whole game they keep throwing at us. And we'll get to that in a minute. But he was like, you know, I want representation that I can respect the person. I may not agree with them. I may not agree with the policy, the position. I may not agree with the idea of where it's going to take us. But I respect them as a person. And he said, we've lost that. We've lost that on the right. We've lost that on the left. We've lost it in the middle. And, you know, as he brought that up, I started thinking myself, like, look, you know, there used to be politicians that I respected them. I respected their office, the position that they held. Hated their policies and were very clear about that, but never to the point of demonizing them personally. We're now in this culture of, it's not even about the policies anymore. It's about the person and demonizing them. But I said, look, you know, I look at Herschel Walker as someone who should have never been on the ballot. He wanted to run for school board. He wanted to run for dog catcher. He wanted to run at some level where he's going to work his way up, have some accomplishments. Great. Want to see that. But to go for, you know, the top job, and this is the Trump effect. And even this gentleman was, you know, not a huge Trump supporter. Voted for him twice, not a supporter. Not didn't buy the hat, if you will. But said there's a thirst out there of people who aren't politicians. And he said, you know, the fear is that in this state, people cling to that with Herschel Walker, that he's not a politician. He's an outsider. He's a fresh voice. He said, now, look, I have a problem with, you know, the honesty. I have a problem with the storytelling. I have the problem with the fantasy. And he brought up the talking points, not me. You know, the wolf's blood or whatever it was. I can't even get them all straight. is how bizarre this campaign has been. And the fact that we're in a runoff says a lot about the state and the voters, but I think it speaks volumes about how difficult it is to vote. And as we were, spending about 20 minutes together, solving the world's problems, as you do, it came back to there were some parts that we agreed on. And this is where my mind went into this spot of, for today, where are the agreement points? The agreement points are, it shouldn't be this difficult to vote. It should not be, the Tuesday from, 7 in the morning till 8 p.m. It shouldn't be our entire system based on people being able to find time in their day to go wait in line for 7-8 hours like we've seen in the past 10 hours in Cleveland the one time. It shouldn't be this hard. We can do lots of things in very short periods of time. Voting shouldn't take this long. It shouldn't be this difficult. We should have, all of the things that, same day registration, early mail-in balloting. And this was a conservative saying, yeah, I'm in favor of early voting. I'm in favor of people voting. And even he even said, I don't know when this became a partisan issue. Which got us to the discussion that I wanted to spend a little time on today. Because again, we're being force-fed this right-left frame. We're being force-fed this at every opportunity. And even this guy was saying, the left is, too far to the left. And I would retort with, well, the right kind of did, trash our capital. Even if you're not going to call it an insurrection or a coup attempt, they defecated on the floor. They urinated on people's desks. This is not the high water of debate. This is kind of the worst possible outcome here. And again, agreement. We agreed. But the point that I made that he stopped and he thought on, and again, this is why discussions are important. Said at the end of it, we're force-fed this right-left frame because it keeps us pitted against each other. It keeps us divided. It keeps me looking at you with a side eye and you looking at me with a side eye and us never doing what we're doing here, which is having a civil conversation, knowing that we can't change the world. We might be able to change each other's minds. We might be able to make a point that makes people think a little differently, which is all I try and do. But we're still focused on that. It's the right versus the left. It's my red hat versus your blue hat. As I've been saying, it's not red hat, blue hat. It's hard hat. It's the working class people of this country. And this is where I go to this point. Not new for regular listeners. The idea that they keep pitting us in these polar opposite positions that were staked against each other. And it's, every election is the last and every election is the most important on both sides. They do this on both sides. And, from your perspective, it's true. I mean, I look at the right and I go, this could be one of the last elections had things gone differently. I look at Pennsylvania. Had we governor-elect Doug Mastriano, the future of elections would not be secure in my view. A guy who has said that if he didn't like the results, we'll figure it out. This is what happens in situations where you have desperation. People are now seeking camps. When we are a we society, when people are doing better together, when all of us are doing better, when all of us are doing better, kind of that frame, we all do better when we all do better. You don't have these mass extremes because I keep coming back to this and no one has been able to knock me off this position. This idea that we all want to end up in the same spot. We all have the same kind of destination in mind. We all want good schools for our kids. We all want safe neighborhoods for our children to play in. We want good social services. We want the roads paved. We want bridges that don't collapse. We want a healthcare system that takes care of us when we're ill. We want an education system that's going to bring out our better selves and give us opportunity and all of that stuff. I think we all want this. It's just different paths, whether you're going to take the right path or the left path. instead of going, you know what? We're going to go right down the middle of the road. We're going to get in the truck and we're going to drive on the road. Because there are things that we agree on. Now, the things we can't agree on, and understand, there are philosophical things that never the right and the left will agree on. You know, as much as Joe Walsh and I, the former congressman from Illinois, are friendly now, as much as we're fighting in the same direction to save democracy and people's right to vote and all that, there still are major differences in our political ideology and our philosophies. There still are massive policy differences. That's where we should be fighting. Not over... This election in Georgia, to me, is just, it's remarkable in the fact that you have one person who clearly not qualified. And that's Herschel Walker. I keep coming back to this. I'm often amazed that we put aside so much of the what's right in front of us. The hypocrisy, the untruths, if you will. And for me, the hope is that the people of Georgia do get out to vote. And while we're here helping people get out the message and talking with folks about, you know, why this election is so important, and we're going to be covering it, and I want you to participate and chime in and share some thoughts, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com, while we're here on the road. I'm hoping they make a choice. And I'm hoping it's like in Pennsylvania, they made a solid choice. The state of Pennsylvania said, nope, we're not that extreme of a state. I'm hoping the voters of Georgia go, no, we're really not this off the beaten path. May not agree with Raphael Warnock, may not agree with the Reverend, but at least he's an honorable person. And I know I'm going to get some hate mail for that, and I welcome it, because I look at this election as very cut and dry. It's very simple, and I'm hoping the folks of Georgia, I'm hoping they see it that way as well. Going to take a quick break right here. I'm going to come back. I want to share some more of the conversation that we had here recently. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Remember, if you miss any portion of the program, you can always download the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you can find ours. Also, remember, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible 2-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to therickssmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at therickssmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So again, I want to go back to this frame. I want to go back to this frame because I think it's important. This idea that it's about right and left. And this is where my conservative friend and I, where we had some real strong conversation around the idea of it being top down. And this idea, again, I go back to my frame of there are things that we can agree on. And one of those things was there's too much wealth consolidation. There's too much mass consolidation of corporate America. There's too much power in the hands of too few. And this is, for me, the way forward. You know, again, the far right, the far left, you know, they've got their issues. But the thing that I think unites us is the idea that mass consolidation of corporations, or what we used to call monopolization, monopoly is not a great thing. It was a good game. We used to play it as a kid. Loved it as a game. As a game, taught lessons, and that lesson is one person wins. At the end of it, whoever got Park Place and Boardwalk, you generally won, because you were able to screw over the rest of the working class by charging enormous rents. We learned those lessons as kids, but seem to have forgotten them as adults. And again, I come back to this conversation where, when I started talking about trade, when I started talking about jobs, when I started talking about breaking up big corporations and more competition, my conservative friend's ears perked right up. And he's like, yes, that. This is what we should be fighting for. This is what this is the direction we should be rowing. And my comment to him, and this is where the epiphany for him came in, because I saved the punchline for later in the conversation, which is, this is why fighting the red hat, blue hat, that isn't the fight. It's the hard hat. This is where the right-left frame, this is where, for me, it breaks down. It's about the kitchen table. It's about ensuring that families have an opportunity to put food on the table. We went across a good portion of this country in the month of October. And nobody talked about any of the divisive stuff that the F channel and outrage radio keeps force-feeding a large segment of our population. Nobody brought that up. They brought back the want for those jobs to come back, that opportunity. And when you drill down to it, and this is the important part, when you drill down to it, nobody wants those steel mill jobs back. The steel workers don't even want, my steel worker friends that I knew growing up who lost those jobs, they don't even really want those jobs back. They were grueling, hard work, dirty, nasty kind of jobs. But what they did, they supported a family. They gave great opportunities for you know, people's families, for their kids, you know, allowed them to lead a life that, well, much like I say all the time, I could have never imagined as a kid. And I go back to this time and time again, that the reality is people want those union jobs back. They want those wages. They want those benefits, the health care, the health security, the retirement security. They want that center of the community back. They want that thing that tied them together. They want that thing that made their community special. They want to be part of that community. And for so long, we've been force-fed this hooray for me and the heck with everybody else ideology that we've forgotten community. There was a point in our country's history, again, interestingly enough, the point in time being when my red hat wearing friends like to point about when they want to make America great again, they point to, you know, the 50s. That was the high point of the we community, the high point of people coming together, the high point in using government to solve problems, using government to fix that which we couldn't do individually. Using our collective ability to make tomorrow better for our children. That's what people point to when they go, we're going to make America great again. That's the era. That's the idea. Now, again, some of them point to the homophobia and the racism and the misogyny and all that. And yes, that's absolutely valid and true. It's what happens. But comes back down to that opportunity. Yeah, you got that job at the factory. You spent your 40 years, you got the gold watch. But you know what you got? You got a family that never wanted for anything. You got kids who had opportunity better than you had. You knew your kids were going to have a better chance than you had. And you got security. You got health security. You got retirement security. You had somebody who was fighting for you. And sadly, that social compact, that thing that tied us together, well, sadly, it's been broken down. And it's been broken down because of bad policy. And I keep coming back to this. The Reagan era was a horrible time for working people. Basically the 70s into Reagan was a horrible time for working people because it was all about making corporate America whole and happy. And for me, this is, there's an opportunity here. There's a moment here where I truly think that we could recreate some of that. We could make this a better place for our kids. Seems like something we could do. Love to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickSmithShow.com. Here back in Atlanta, Georgia for the big runoff. And I'm sitting here with Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, or more aptly, the most dangerous woman in the country. So, Randy, the most dangerous. Do you feel dangerous?
I mean, look, if I'm dangerous to Mike Pompeo and he thinks I'm more dangerous than the worst dictator in the worst dictators in the world, that means that they feel very fearful about public education and how public education opens kids' minds. It was a ridiculous, pathetic and dangerous thing for him to say, given the circumstances of life these days. But what I found most pathetic and heinous was when he said that what teachers teach is filth. What teachers teach is helping kids unlock their minds and see their potential and see the American dream and the possibility of it. And that's what I found to be most heinous.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of this, you know, education is not their highest priority.
Well,
I mean, I go back to the Trump statement. I love the poorly educated because they keep voting for him.
I think it's actually even worse than it's not their priority. I think that they, and you see it with what DeVos has done and others. You know, Pompeo is just one in any number of these extremist ideologues who hate public education that then use the smear and the lie to try to denigrate those of us who have spent our life devoted to helping kids achieve and learn and, you know, do whatever they want to do in their lives. But I don't think it's that it's a low priority. I think they intentionally want to destroy public education. I think that there's, you know, they've tried to defund it for how many years? They've tried to compete with it for how many years? This is now denigrating the very people who teach. Again, I'll go back to Pompeo is not a dumb guy. He's a West Point guy. Yeah. He was the head of the CIA. He was the Secretary of State. Even under a Trump administration, that means you got to be pretty smart to do those jobs. And the fact that he would call what teachers teach filth, the fact that these extremist groups would spend $50 million in you know, the run up to November 8th, trying to undermine and scare people about trans issues. Think about how vulnerable trans kids feel right now and their families feel. The fact that they, you know, want to censor honest history, ban books like The Diary of Anne Frank, The Teaching of Ruby Bridges, and they really believed that their culture wars would divide parents and teachers and create this division and chaos. And it didn't work. Just like the election deniers didn't win on November 8th, this level of war on knowledge and war on the people who help kids just didn't work. So I think what you're seeing with what Pompeo did is that he's just trying to out-MAGA the MAGAs.
Yep, he's trying to ramp up the outrage. And look, you know, on a lot of these issues, my problem with what the Pompeos and the Trumps do is they point fingers at something and create problems with no solutions.
Exactly right.
You know, in my workplace, and I've talked about this a number of times over the last several months, in my workplace 30 years ago, we dealt with the trans issue. We had, you know, Ron went away. He came back, was Ronna. Do you know who cared? Nobody.
Right.
You know, the union and the company got together, figured out the logistics, and, you know, Ronna went to work, did her job, went home, let her life. Wasn't a problem. Why now is it the end of humanity? I don't get it. And look, I don't understand the whole trans issue, I'll be honest, but I know one thing. I know I don't want government making any choices about what people can and can't do with their lives.
And, you know, it's the whole, you know, as someone who was a closeted gay person for much of my high school life, you know, it's really terrible. And you have a terrible sense of yourself when you can't be who you think you are. And instead of suppressing it and hiding it and making it wrong and evil because you're afraid of it, which is basically what the extremists are, they're afraid of it. Why can't we actually meet people where they are and help them be the wanted, loved people that God tells us he or she or they want to love? I mean, it feels like it's a matter of fear and hate and division that may play well to a certain base, but in the long run, America is stronger when we embrace people for who they are and help them lift themselves, help them lift themselves to, you know, new heights and new potential. But it's clearly a matter of an intentional attempt to, you know, divide and misinform. And what happens is that people just get really hurt. I mean, and who gets most hurt? The most vulnerable.
Yeah. No, the kids in the working class, ultimately.
And that's why, I mean, that's why, look, Rick, people like you, people like me, we can't be scared of this and we have to stand up to it. Do it in a smart way, but we have to stand up for the things that matter. And what matters to kids right now is they get a good education. They're in a safe and welcoming environment. They, you know, we have real options for them, like college and career. I like that, you know, Governor-elect Shapiro in Pennsylvania talks about, you know, career tech ed and voc ed as a real opportunity and for kids. We got to make sure that kids, you know, can read proficiently. We got to make sure that they're catching up on math. And we got to make sure that we deal with the loneliness and the mental health crises that are going on right now. So, you know, sticks and stones can break your, sticks and stones can break your bones, but names can never harm you. And I feel like we, in terms of labor and public education, we got to fight for the conditions that we need to help kids soar.
Which brings us here to Georgia, why I think you're here and why we're here covering what's going on. This race, while it's not going to decide who wins the Senate, it is an important race. I mean, the eyes of the nation are watching. I think you have, everyone's been focused on Herschel Walker and all the horrible, but I don't think people have talked about how good of a guy Reverend Warnock is.
Exactly right. I mean, it is shocking to me, given Reverend Warnock's record in Georgia and record in the Senate in the 2 years that he's been there, just how close, you know, the November 8th election was. And I think that was because people saw it as a referendum of who controlled the U.S. Senate.
Right.
At the end of the day, when you just have a matchup between Reverend Warnock and Herschel Walker, it's a no-brainer here.
It should be a no-brainer. It should have been a no-brainer a month ago.
And I mean, it should be, because what Warnock represents, what the Reverend represents, is he is the embodiment of who people want in a senator, someone who represents, someone who hears, someone who fights for the people in not only in Georgia, but in the nation. And his record is pretty remarkable in a 2-year period of time. You reduce the cost of drugs. You reduce the cost of student debt. You have an infrastructure law, the American Rescue Law, that basically saved Georgians from the ravages, a lot of the ravages of the pandemic. You have the CHIPS law. You have the work in terms of veterans. And this is what the Reverend went to the Senate for. And then you have, just Herschel Walker talking about vampires and werewolves. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you don't even know whether, just like Oz, did he live in New Jersey? Did he live in Pennsylvania? Warnock, where's his primary residence? And why is it so hard to say it? And who do you really, Walker, who do you really represent anyway? So but the reason that labor is in the House in Georgia and we have scores of AFT volunteers here, and I'm here today working with our volunteers as they're knocking on doors, working with Unite Here volunteers as they're knocking on doors, doing the hard work of bringing out the vote and making sure that people who want to vote can vote, know how to vote. And this weekend, it was pretty awesome to see that level of early vote in Georgia.
No, it's impressive. But, you look at what's going on here and how hard it is to vote, how they've attempted to rig even this. And the people that we're talking to, it shouldn't be this difficult, I guess, where I'm going.
It shouldn't be. I was at the International Trade Union Conference a couple of weeks ago and was so inspired to talk to the folks from Brazil and what happened in Lula's election. And at the end of the day, Bolsonaro, others tried to make it really hard to vote, tried to create all sorts of intimidation, tried to do all of that stuff to stop people from voting for Lula. And the forces of democracy and the forces of decency and working people all throughout Brazil came together. And that's what I'm seeing in Georgia. It's just a matter of it shouldn't be that hard.
Yeah.
But sometimes you got to stand up for working people, and sometimes you got to stand up for democracy, and you got to stand up for freedom. And the struggle is always there, and you got to overcome the struggle. And that is what people are doing by knocking on doors and getting postcards out and making phone calls. And that is part of the fabric of what real democracy is. I just always wonder, what are the people who want to suppress votes, what are they afraid of? Why are they afraid of Americans exercising their vote? Shouldn't we have a country where we are encouraging everybody to vote and make it easy to do so?
Yeah, well, we believe that, but the people at the top in the power positions, they just want to remain there. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with the most dangerous woman in the entire world, according to Mike Pompeo. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, AFT.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media so you can check out the work that they do. So, back to Warnock, because, the policies, I don't know what Walker stands for. There's just a bunch of insanity. What's Warnock going to do to help make things better for working people? I keep hearing this from work. Well, what's he going to do? Because we're focused on all the negative.
Right. But let's look at what Warnock has already done. Which is we're in the middle of the aftershocks of COVID, and we're in the middle of inflation and supply chains and all of this. And Warnock is a problem solver. He's been in Washington to drive down costs, to drive up wages, to make sure that public schools have the funding that they need, to make sure that people have a path to a better life. That is who Reverend Warnock is. And in the first 2 years, he's done a whole bunch of these things, including being the one who really pushed to cap the cost of insulin at $35, to cap the cost of prescription drugs for those on Medicare at no more than $2,000 for a year, to make sure that kids have public education, that workers have access to a union and the power to really determine what they and their families want in their lives. So what I'm hoping that that the Reverend does in the next 6 years, you know, after, if he gets, you know, reelected, and we're fighting to have him reelected on December 6th, what I'm hoping is we actually stand up for the values that are not only in the Constitution and the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment in particular, but the values of humanness and decency and freedom and democracy and shared prosperity and opportunity for all. That's what I hear every time I hear Reverend Warnock speak, and he does it with passion, and he does it with firmness and tenacity. And that's who we need in the Senate, both Georgians as well as all Americans.
Yeah, so last question I've got for you, because, you know, like I said, the Senate is, you know, the Democrats are going to control that. You know, what does it matter if Warnock's there or not?
Well, it really does actually matter that you have a Senate that has a deliberate majority, and that, frankly, that I mean, you know, the President Biden joked a few months ago that when it's so equally divided, everybody's the president.
Yeah.
Everybody has the veto power. It's really important, I think, that it's not 50-50, that it's 51-49, that it's that there is a real working majority, that, you know, the vice president can actually go do her job,
right,
instead of constantly breaking ties.
Do they end the filibuster?
That there's, you know, subpoena power, that there are others of these powers. And I think that where it comes to real issues, real voting for freedom, like, you know, what to do in the aftermath of Roe versus Wade being being overturned, that there needs to be pressure, including the consideration of ending the filibuster. There needs to be pressure on ensuring that the Congress is on a path towards freedom and justice for all. So I don't know if they end the filibuster or not, given where the House is. But I do know that if the filibuster had been ended already, we would have, we wouldn't have a situation where a 10-year-old girl who was raped in Ohio would have to go across state lines to try to, have an abortion, where people who, are miscarry, their doctors don't know if they can help them or not. The level of drama and terrible stories that we've heard in the aftermath of the ending of Roe has been terrible in some of these states. And we owe it to Americans to have more decency and more humanity.
No, I mean, the cruelty is the point, and that's the sad reality. Randy, I appreciate the time. As always, great seeing you. Keep up the great work, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Thanks, Rick.
Good stuff. Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT.org, the website. Going to take a quick break back here from Atlanta. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2012. That was the day that more than 100 fast food workers in New York City walked off the job. They held a one-day strike for better wages and the right to form a union. It was the biggest fast food workers' strike up until that time. The movement soon grew to be much, much bigger. Their demand was simple and memorable: a $15 an hour minimum wage. The slogan became the Fight for 15 and a Union. The campaign found an ally in SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. By August of 2013, the movement held held a national strike against low pay day of action. Fast food workers and their supporters held demonstrations in 60 cities. Today, the movement has spread to 300 cities and beyond the United States. While protesters have gathered at many fast food chains, McDonald's has become a focus of the campaign. Protesters have held annual one-day demonstrations at McDonald's headquarters just outside of Chicago. The campaign has seen victories. Both New York and California have passed a $15 an hour minimum wage law. So has the city of Seattle. Although it's a national and even international movement, it is also a grassroots effort. In each city, different local groups are involved. In Kansas City, fast food women workers have formed the Fannie Lou Hamer Women's Committee. They named their group after the civil rights champion. They take inspiration from her famous quote that she was sick and tired of being sick and tired. For many in the Fight for 15 movement, this sums up their involvement. It is a movement for the respect and dignity of workers and the right to earn a living wage.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, again, you look at being here in Atlanta, and some of the conversations around education have been really fascinating because it's one of those central issues that everyone goes, hey, you know, we want the best education for our kids. And yeah, we do. It's kind of simple when you stop and think about it. But who policy-wise... And this is where some of those conversations today, as we were out talking with voters, as we were out talking to union members, when the education issue came up, you look at Herschel Walker and you go, really? I mean, because this is where I'm struggling. I'm struggling with, is that what you want your kids to emulate? This is a very simple choice in my view. And it comes back to, you know, we talk about how much we care about the children. Care about how much the pressure, the impressions of the children. I'm going, wait a second. You know, how can you, on any level then, if it's about the children, if we care, if we truly care, how do you look at Herschel Walker and go, yeah, that's, yeah. Now, he was an excellent athlete. He was a fantastic football player. Give him credit for that. That's his lane. He should be staying there. And voters should be saying that. This shouldn't be one of those scenarios where you're going, well, you know, he could run really fast, so he might be good in the Senate. maybe if, you know, you're leading the insurrection, you know, every January and he needs to get away, I get that, but I'm just not seeing it. And, you know, there were some Herschel Walker supporters that we ran into. And the weird thing is when you ask them, you know, the follow-up question, which is, why? Duh. The responses were quite canned. The responses were, you know, wow, Marxist, socialist. And you would try. And look, the point is not to argue with folks on their position. At this juncture, you're not changing hearts and minds. You're not getting people to go, oh, I had an epiphany. You're right. That doesn't happen. What right now is about is getting people out to vote, getting people excited to vote, and explaining the reasons why you need to vote and why in this moment, up until these next couple of days, the rest of your life needs to have a moment that's on hold where you're defending democracy. That's the point that I think is most important here. You know, there's all these, you know, all the talking points on both sides. Everyone's got their view. For me, this is a very simple thing. And I reach out to conservatives to think a little bit. You know, seriously, is this, you know, if you're truly concerned about the children and they're learning and they're rotten and their arithmetic, is Herschel Walker the guy that's going to bring that? Now, to be honest, I did have someone who was quite frank. Don't care anything about Herschel Walker. He's an R. that R is going to get us another vote to stop that evil. And this was a quote, to stop that evil Nancy Pelosi, even though Pelosi's no longer going to be speaker and she's not in the Senate. But I digress slightly in that this is one of those interesting moments where Walker hasn't really answered any questions. I don't know what his positions are. I don't think he knows what his positions are. And the voters don't know. This is where, again, we need to be vetting people just a smidge bit better. But the sad reality is this is how far the Republican Party has gone off the beaten path. This is how far they've gone away from reality. That they're putting, you know, tons of energy, tons of money, tons of effort into getting, well, someone who, you know, quite honestly, I don't even know. You know, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at. Now, make the defense. If there's someone who can make a cogent argument about why Herschel Walker, outside of I don't care what his past is, I don't care that, you know, all of the allegations, I don't care about, you know, the playing Russian roulette, I don't care about any of that. I just need another R. I understand that. Don't agree with it, but I do understand it. But you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Tell me what you think. I got to know. All negative emails go to the top because I find those most interesting. And stick around. You're going to want to hear a doozy that I responded recently to. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. More working people come to talk.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, here in Atlanta, Georgia, here for the Georgia runoff election, and spent some time today, you know, with my Teamster brothers and sisters out talking with members and getting some of the reactions that, you know, I got to tell you, I find very interesting. I find it interesting that you have, you know, union voters who are going to look at someone like Herschel Walker and go, that's my guy. When you have Raphael Warnock, who voted to save their pensions, when you have someone like Warnock, who is going to support the right of workers to join and form unions, going to support the right of workers to be encouraged to do that. We've heard nothing out of the Walker camp about organizing and about jobs. And in fact, I haven't heard a lot of much. In fact, you know, the reality is, I don't think he's answered a question from the media or from any reporters in a couple of months. And you start thinking about, you know, how, you know, this isn't how government is supposed to be run when you have somebody who completely unaccountable, unwilling to answer any questions, unwilling to, you know, to run a campaign. And then there are people who go, yeah, that's our guy. I struggle with that. I struggle with it mightily. And you know, I got a lot of today, the religious frame. You know, we care about, you know, the babies, and we care about, you know, religious stuff and, you know, all this. And you go, I'm confused. Because, you know, if religion is your thing, if you know, your faith is your thing, you literally have a reverend, a person who has devoted his life to good. I mean, this really is an interesting moment where you have, you know, one guy who's, you know, living the Christian lifestyle, you know, married to the same woman, you know, no abortions that have been brought forth by women saying, no, none of that. And then you've got, well, Herschel Walker, who has been the poster child of what the right is supposed to be against. And that's the part that I'm struggling with. Like, I get you bought the hat. I get that. You bought the hat. Oh, we got the T-shirt. We put the flag in the ground. I got it. Got it. I'm an R. I get it. But this guy, I mean, it's almost sad. And it got me thinking today and having a conversation around, you know, the movie Idiocracy, if you've ever seen that, where it really wasn't about governing. It was you know, a sideshow. It was, you know, it was politic for entertainment's sake. And everything was breaking down. This is kind of where we are. And I go back to what we talked about in the last segment, this idea of being on these teams, these polar opposites, where we're not talking about how we're moving forward, how we're going to solve problems. And I keep coming back to this. There's a moment where you have to solve society's problems. You have to at least try. Hunger, poverty, homelessness, you know, poor educational opportunities, you know, healthcare, you know, all these problems that Republicans are great at pointing out. It's like the cartoon dog, you know, pointing his finger over there, over there, over there, without any solutions. Because the sad reality is, while they're pointing their finger over there and getting us to look over there, over here, they're robbing us blind. And this is where, you know, having that conversation around, you know, back in the old days when we used to tax the very wealthy and we used to tax corporate America, things were a little different. And this is why I'm in this weird moment, because, you know, I look at someone like Herschel Walker, who, you know, just, you know, 5 years ago would have been completely unelectable. But here we are with a guy who, you know, almost won the vote. And there's a real concern right now on the ground that the enthusiasm isn't there because the Senate's already been decided. Democrats are going to hold the Senate. That this election isn't as important as it was in the past. And that's a concern. Now, I did have a conversation with someone who said, look, you know, Herschel Walker is going to be a yes man vote. He's not going to actually go and do the work. And, you know, I said this already. He's going to be the rubber stamp for corporate America. He's going to be the rubber stamp for taking rights away from women and minorities, and which is very bizarre, but that's the reality. And it comes back to this team sport. This team sport, it's mind-blowing to me. Now, when we did our tour, and we talked to a lot of Republicans, we talked to a lot of people, the first thing out of the bag was always jobs, the economy. First thing was always, you know, better life, you know, this kind of stuff. Now it's the social issues. It's the transgenders. It's what we've heard on outrage radio for years. So you get where it's coming from. You get how, you know, a large portion of our population has been indoctrinated with crazy talk. What 10 years ago we would have called crazy talk. It's insane. Why would you say or think such a, how do you think this guy's qualified to be in that office? But now we're so, well, in our camps that it doesn't matter. Now the scary part, and this is where I think, you know, Democrats and you know, sane, rational people had better be concerned. I look at Pennsylvania, where someone like Doug Mastriano pulled, you know, 42% of the vote, 40% of the vote. A large chunk of my neighbors voted for somebody who, wow, as close to a Nazi as we've had in a very long time. And I don't say that lightly. Someone who, you know, an election denier, was there for the insurrection. You know, wanted to, you know, gut education, wanted to privatize, was going to, you know, push that the whole no rights at work agenda, was going to do all these draconian things in his mind to make us the Florida of the Northeast. And look, you know, if he gets his way on climate change, man, we may be. But the sad reality is he's still got a large portion of the vote. A lot of people pulled that lever. For someone who 10 years ago wholly unelectable. So I generally ask people, you know, well, I'm voting for, you know, if you don't mind me asking, you know, why? What is it that attracts you to his campaign? And sadly, you know, what keeps coming back is it's the abortion issue, which oddly enough, there are now two women who have come forth and say that, you know, he paid them and, you know, coerced them into having abortions. And one of the memes that I saw was, you know, was spot on, where a woman, you know, asked the question, do I have to be Herschel Walker's girlfriend to get an abortion? I don't know. Again, this is a do as I say, not as I do kind of moment. And I look at this and I keep coming back to, how is it we've gotten to this place where someone like Walker is palatable? And it's because we're so polarized. It's because we're in our camps that it doesn't matter who gets thrown up. As long as he's on the right team, as long as he got the right letter behind his name, as long as they're one of us. Even if they're not one of us. And that's the weird part of this. I got that vibe a bunch as well. You know what I didn't hear from anyone who was going to support Walker? How he was going to work to make their lives better. And that's the weird part in all of this. Because, you know, for me, you know, politics is about, you know, who gets what. And the wealthy and powerful will continue to get what they want. And the rest of us, not so much. And this is why I'm hoping, again, hoping that we have this awakening moment. We come to some bit of reality. But it's not going to be anytime soon. I look at the fact that our former president, and am I surprised that he had dinner with a white supremacist? No, I'm not surprised by it. Am I surprised that he's not pushing back on it? No, I'm not surprised. A little, not, I don't want to use surprised. A little hopeful. Because you see people like Marco Rubio, who came out and said that, told CNN that this white supremacist, this Nick Fuentes, was a purveyor and a spreader of an evil poison. And, you know, basically he said that, you know, but Trump isn't an anti-Semite. Yeah, sure, he surrounds himself with anti-Semites, but it's not him. And he said that he hopes Trump would condemn Fuentes for his positions. But he said, look, I know Donald Trump's not an anti-Semite. I can tell you that for a fact. Donald Trump is not, but this guy is evil. It's this guy over here. Everybody, look over here. Look at this guy. Never mind the Donald Trump part of it. It's this nasty, disgusting person. This, in his words, quote, this ass clown. A U.S. senator says that on TV. And I'm going, okay, I get it. You want us to be distracted. You want us to look over here and go, yeah, that Nick Fuentes is a bad guy. And he is. Without going, why would you have Donald Trump, why would you have him in the same room with you? You know, did your mother never tell you you're judged by the people you keep company with, the people you break bread with? Did mom never tell you that? Didn't they teach you that at the boarding school? So it's interesting in watching as the Republican Party, now you see the full-on attempt to purge him from the party happening right before our very eyes. This is happening. When you get Pat Boone to come out and say that he's praying Trump doesn't run again, that becomes a moment of interest. That becomes, oh, wow, Pat Robertson doesn't, or, I mean, Pat Boone. I keep saying Pat Robertson. Pat Boone, you know, I'm surprised he didn't sing it. But said, you know, he doesn't think Trump should run again. He said, I don't think there are enough Republicans who would vote for him so he could be elected. But he was his own worst enemy in his manner and his speech. And he made so many enemies that while he could be a great president again, if he muted his speech and all of that, which I'm not sure he's capable of, I would advise him, please don't run. I think you will divide the Republican Party even more. I go, yeah. It's like Mike Lindell running for the RNC head, which I hope he gets. I hope he gets his wish, his hope, his demand. Hope he gets it. Want him to get it. Want him to be the head of the RNC. Maybe Randy Quaid can be his co-chair. Maybe the both of them can turn that circus, well, into a circus. Now, what I find interesting are the people who are trying to defend Trump, people like Rubio, trying to defend him. Well, you know, he's not an anti-Semite. He's none of those. No, he just surrounds himself with them. Now, you have some other ones, you know, Susan Collins, Bill Cassidy. You've got some who are condemning him, saying you should condemn this white nationalist, Nick Fuentes. You should do all these things. Interestingly enough, none of them are up for election in 2024. The other one, being here in Georgia, I see Brian Kemp has come out and basically slammed Trump for having dinner with this white supremacist. Then you go, there it is. Brian Kemp is now officially a candidate for president in 2024. Because, look, we know he set up a super PAC here recently, trying to take in some money. The thought was he might run for Senate, but I'm telling you, aspirations at the top. There's going to be a void when Trump falls. And, you know, I keep saying the hope is that come election time, that happens, that we get the chance to in a resounding fashion, turn him away. But here's the thing. This is where the concern is. Someone like Mastriano got 42% of the vote. Someone that 10 years ago we would have found wholly unacceptable on either side of the aisle. So there's something going on here. There's a moment here that we've got to pay attention to. And I'll tell you, this election means a lot more than just, you know, another seat in the U.S. Senate. This is kind of for the heart and soul. And my fear is people are tired. You know, we've talked to a number of people who are just going, oh, I'm just tired. This is too much. And that's part of the plan. That's part of the game. Get us worn out, wear us down. I just want to be left alone so that you drop out and you don't vote. That's why this election, for my listeners in Georgia, this election is that important. You know, I sat and I thought about it. You know, because as I have these conversations with people, you know, new things pop up all the time. You know, for instance, this is one of those amazing, for instance, the home that Herschel Walker claimed that was his, that he lives in to claim residency here in Georgia, evidently he rented out just before he launched his campaign. So where he says he actually lives, he doesn't, unless he's squatting with somebody, but not really his home in Atlanta. So where is Herschel? I don't know, you know, and this is kind of got to be a problem going forward, which is why I hope come Tuesday next week, the people of Georgia get out. I'm hoping they find their enthusiasm. They find their enthusiasm and they get out and they vote. That is the ultimate hope in my view. And we end up with someone like Raphael Warnock, who is a good, decent man. Everything I've seen is a good, decent man. If religion is your thing, he's a good man of the cloth, but still just at the end of it, a good, decent guy. Someone who cares about his fellow citizens, someone who cares about workers, someone who cares about our society. I can't say that about Herschel Walker. And that is frustrating. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break right back here from Atlanta. If you missed any portion of the program, make sure you download the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find ours. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people on the talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1832. American author Louisa May Alcott was born in Germantown, Pennsylvania. Alcott is most well known for her classic book Little Women and its two sequels. She also wrote a novel called Work, A Story of Experience. Alcott drew on her personal experiences for the novel. She herself had to go to work to support her family at an early age. She worked as a teacher, a seamstress, a governess, and a writer. In her novel, Alcott tells
the story of Christy Devon, a young woman trying to support herself in spite of all the odds stacked against her. In the book, Christy makes the difficult decision to leave her family to enter the workforce. She explains to her uncle, "I am willing to work, but I want work that I can put my heart into and feel that it does me good. No matter how hard it is, I only ask for a chance to be a useful, happy woman, and I don't think that is a bad ambition." She starts with several odd jobs, and the book traces Christy's journey as she tries different work opportunities. The book ends with Christy becoming an activist, giving a new voice to working women. The novel explores issues of social justice, women's rights, and their roles beyond the family. This book also uncovers the changing nature of women's work in the new industrial era. Although it's a fictional account, the book captures the experiences of many women of that age. As Alcott wrote, "Christy was one of that large class of women who, moderately endowed with talents, earnest and true-hearted, are driven by necessity, temperament, or principle out into the world to find support, happiness, and homes for themselves."
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Atlanta, Georgia. And I got to say, I love Atlanta. Traffic. Wow. 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 Did I mention wow? The traffic? That. Look, I've got a lot of miles under my belt. I've got a lot of miles. Some of the most interesting driving that I have seen in a very long time right here in the ATL. Very, very interesting. And look, when in Rome, you kind of, I have seen more people run stop signs and red lights here in Atlanta than I've seen probably in all of the 1.5 to 2 million miles that I've driven. Wow. I guess that's the best I can come up with. But you know, this is where, you know, public transit. How do I use public transit? Because it's got to be safer. But the area, lovely, lovely place. I've had a wonderful time. And look, at the end of the day, you know, there's this, there are these preconceived notions about, you know, the South and the folks that we've met. And look, even people we've disagreed with. And there have been, shockingly, people who disagree with me, they face-to-face, very cordial. And it gave us this opportunity to talk about, you know, social media, to talk about, you know, Twitter. We've spent a lot of time on Elon Musk and that nonsense and that, you know, that show. But the reality, we got to get back to this face-to-face stuff. And that's why I think what the unions are doing here, going out, talking to their members, going out and talking to voters, educating on real issues, not on the things that outrage radio feeds people, but actually the issues. And for the Teamsters that I spent the day with, you know, their issues were, look, you know, Joe Biden signed the Bush-Lewis Act into law that is going to save, you know, millions of retirees, going to save their pensions. Donald Trump didn't do it. Barack Obama didn't do it. Joe Biden did. This has been something that they have been trying to get help with for a very long time. Now, understand, you know, what's happened to the pension system in this country is the employers have gone, hey, we're gonna not fund it, and then we're going to rob it blind when we file bankruptcy. And, oh, yeah, we're going to crush unions so that there are no new members to be in these plans. So if you're not going to have laws that encourage people to join and form unions, you're not going to have laws that make it easier and more streamlined, even in a place like here in Atlanta, you're going to have problems. And that pension issue is a big one, along with, you know, the PRO Act, getting more people. I can't tell you how many people that we've run into here who've gone, yeah, gee, I'm not in the union, but boy, I sure wish I was. I sure wish I were a member. I sure wish I had that opportunity. I sure wish, boy, sure wish that that were something that, I could do. But sadly, and again, I keep coming back to this, sadly, our laws are so badly broken and antiquated. And this is why I come back to why this election is important. Ensuring that someone like Raphael Warnock is in the Senate pushing for workers' rights, pushing for the ability to join and form unions. And look, you know, if we had 60 senators, you know, back in the old days, there used to be Republicans who supported this too. It isn't that partisan of an issue. But again, I look at what happened in Chicago, and you know, look at what happened in Illinois. This idea that, you know, if you let those unions have their rights, it's gonna be bad for the rest of us. If you let workers have rights, it's gonna be bad. And it kind of goes to show you that they still fear organized workers because they know what it means. It means less profit for them. Now, it means better communities. It means stronger schools. It means a lot of positive things, but it means less profit for the wealth class. And we can't have that. Can't have that at all.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I've been waiting all day. In fact, I've been waiting a couple of days to talk about this email. Now, look, I've got thick skin. I've taken abuse from people over the years. I've gotten threatened. All kinds of stuff. You name it. I've seen just about all of it. And look, I've had people, you know, attack me personally, attack me physically. Appearance-wise, you name it. I've had people, you know, do dumb stuff. But this email got my attention. And it's one of those things that's just, I've had people say, I can't stand you. Every time I turn you off. And I'm like, that's okay. That's called freedom of choice. You have the ability to turn a channel. You don't like what I say. You don't like what I do. That's part of this gig. Some people like it. Some people don't. Some people find me interesting. Some people don't. This woman, she writes me, when your show comes on, I switch over to public radio. She says, I'm a huge supporter of our progressive radio station and progressive causes, union, and your message. So you go, hold on, stop. Then if you agree with what I talk about, you agree with the message, you agree with, you know, the stations that we're on that do the work that they do, why are you leaving? Well, she says, so why do I turn you off? It's your voice. I'm like, okay, you know, okay, maybe you don't like the sound. Look, I don't like the sound of my own voice. Very few people like the sound of their own voice. Look, if it grates on your nerves, I get that. There are some people that, you know, I don't like listening to because it's like nails on a chalkboard. I get it. So I'm like, okay, I get it. She says, I try to tolerate it, but I just can't. Just can't do it. Can't tolerate it. It has, and this is where the fun part comes in. It has, according to her, what I identify as a feigned huskiness in an attempt, I imagine, to emulate that tough, blue-collar, male manual laborer. I think it's feigned because I've heard you do other interviews where you have dropped the affection and just spoke normally. And I go, wait a second. This is how I talk normally. The feigned huskiness of a blue-collar... Who would do that? Honestly, I wrote her back, and we had a couple of emails back and forth where I'm going, here's the thing. It's who I am. I've been a blue-collar worker all my life. In fact, I work on a shipping dock. You know, I drive a truck. My hands are calloused. I got cuts all over them. You know, my boots are dirty. It's who I am. It's not feigned. It's not something that I'm attempting to play up. It's just who I am. And, you know, I played this for my, read this to my wife, and she's like, man, you can't please some people. And you're right, you can't please some people. But here's where it gets interesting. Because you go, well, okay, you don't like the fact that I speak the way I do. And I get that, fine. She goes, you know, why does it bother me? Because according to her, it harks to a time when the labor union movement was dominated by men. It doesn't respect the massive contribution of women in the modern workforce. And frankly, it reminds me of unions' beginnings when men might have been struggling for their own rights in the workforce, but were enforcing male domination at home, often abusive. I don't want to honor those times, so I turn you off. So somehow, I have turned into the proverbial dog for all of the bad things that men have done in the past. Okay, if this is what does it for you, if this is what makes you feel better about yourself, good. You know, turn the channel. I want you to. Because I don't want to cause you grief or pain or harassment or feel somehow abused. But it is interesting that this was the argument. Now, you agree with everything they talk about. You agree with the causes. You agree with the message. But I don't like your delivery. And you go, is it that simple to divide and conquer the working class of this country? And the answer is yes. It is that simple to divide us, to pit us against each other, to slice and dice. But because I'm a man, and this, I got to think this goes well beyond just radio, but it becomes one of these moments where you're going, I can't help you. But if we're this easily divided, if this is something that pits us against each other, because I refuse to respond back with any derogatory comments, I just simply said, I feel sad for you if this is how you feel. I know there's nothing I can do. I apologize in advance for causing you harm. But it's so simple to tear us apart. Because understand the dividing lines. The dividing lines have always been male, female, black, white, gay, straight. You know, you name the fault lines. And the wealth class of this country uses them masterfully to pit us against each other. And for me, this idea that, you know, this was going to be a dividing point instead of something where we could have had a conversation going, you know, hey, you're right. The unions of the past were run by men because that was the workforce. The unions of the past did coalesce around ethnic lines, around race lines. Absolutely, they did. But you learn those lessons. It's like everything. You want to learn from the past and not do it again in the future. It's the same thing when you talk about education and that theory, that theory about race that's critical. You know, why do we teach actual history? Well, so that we don't do it again. Does that seem simple? Does it seem rational, sane? Yes, of course it does, which is probably why not going to happen. But, you know, I found it very interesting that this woman's thought process was, she's going to help me by attacking me. She's going to help me by going, well, you stop being you, be somebody that I like, and then I'll listen. And that's not how this gig works. That's not how the game works. I am who I am. I am unfiltered. You get what you see. I say what I think. But I'm amused that this is a dividing line. I'm amused that this is one of those things that tears us apart, and saddened. Again, I come back to this saddened part. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you've got a thought, a question, if is there something wrong with my voice? Is my huskiness feigned? I wish the huskiness could be feigned in other ways. Outside of my voice. But I want to thank you for the email. And look, it made for good conversations. And this is why I do like extreme emails. I do like people who pick on me. So by all means, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break right here. We're back right after this. Again, if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you download the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you will find ours. Quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2012. That was the day that more than 100 fast food workers in New York City walked off the job. They held a one-day strike for better wages and the right to form a union. It was the biggest fast food workers' strike up until that time. The movement soon grew to be much, much bigger. Their demand was simple and memorable: a $15 an hour minimum wage. The slogan became the Fight for 15 and a Union. The campaign found an ally in SEIU, the Service Employees International Union. By August of 2013, the movement held a national strike against low pay day of action. Fast food workers and their supporters held demonstrations in 60 cities. Today, the movement has spread to 300 cities and beyond the United States. While protesters have gathered at many fast food chains, McDonald's has become a focus of the campaign. Protesters have held annual one-day demonstrations at McDonald's headquarters just outside of Chicago. The campaign has seen victories. Both New York and California have passed a $15 an hour minimum wage law. So has the city of Seattle. Although it's a national and even international movement, it is also a grassroots effort. In each city, different local groups are involved. In Kansas City, fast food women workers have formed the Fannie Lou Hamer Women's Committee. They named their group after the civil rights champion. They take inspiration from her famous quote that she was sick and tired of being sick and tired. For many in the Fight for 15 movement, this sums up their involvement. It is a movement for the respect and dignity of workers and the right to earn a living wage.
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Again, if you miss any portion of the program, podcast, wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours, from iTunes to iHeart, Stitcher to Podbean, everywhere in between. We are there for you. Now, here's interesting sales numbers after Black Friday. Gun sales, third highest gun sale day in history. Got to make the NRA all tingly in the panties, very thrilled by, ooh boy, more guns being sold. I got it. There's part of me that has this thought in my head, however, that a lot of those guns being sold are being sold to, well, people I don't know that the NRA would be thrilled with. Because I got to tell you, the number of people on the left that I have talked to recently who have been going, yep, I don't have a choice. We have a government that won't do anything to protect people in their work, in their spaces. We have a political system that is broken and incapable of dealing with real problems. And the fear, this is the fear that I have, that everyone thinks they're, you know, Wyatt Earp and, you know, it's the wild, wild west. But the manufacturers, oh boy, thrilled. In fact, third best sales day they've ever had. Third best, and that was Black Friday. Now, the other two best days were Black Fridays as well, because they got all the good deals on Black Friday. But 2017 and 2019, those were the other two big days. And I got to wonder, you know, don't we have enough? Again, don't we have enough? And I got into this conversation again around this election cycle on the gun issue. Well, you know, Warnock just wants to take our guns. And I don't know that to be the case. And we had that gun control argument. Comes up every time this issue, you know, rears its head. Talking about, you know, do you believe in gun control or don't you? And the reality is everybody believes in gun control. Everybody. I've yet to meet somebody who goes, you know, Rick, I think I would like you to have a stealth bomber. I think I would like you to have a thermonuclear weapon. I think you would like, I'd like you to have a Scud missile. You know, I've yet to find that person that goes, no, you're special. You have the right to bear these arms. And the reality is we don't. So when you're talking about gun control, talking about the right to bear arms and the right to bear arm control, everyone agrees that there is the right to do it. It's a matter of where you draw the line. Some people are saying, you know, maybe, you know, do we need to have these weapons of war? Now, I go back to, and this is a story I've told before a couple of times, actually. When I first moved to Pennsylvania, I took a job up in a rural part of the state. And one of my first days on the job, there was a guy who was talking about this big gun he bought. And he was, you know, just orgasmic is the word that comes to mind. He was, and again, this is going back, you know, 93. I mean, we're talking a long time ago. So the ammosexual frame wasn't something that people talked about, but he embodied all of this. He embodied all of the ammosexual kind of, because this story that he went on and told that he must have put, you know, just hours of thought into and fantasy into, was one of the most X-rated kind of stories that I think I have ever heard. And it was frightening to me that this person would put the kind of detail, the kind of thought into, well, killing somebody. The fantasy was someone would break into his house and he would whip out his big gun. And, you know, most normal people would go, you know, somebody breaks in my house, I'm gonna take my gun, I'm going to shoot him. And it was that simple. You know, you go, this was a 20-minute, the entire lunch period, a 20-minute fetish, a fantasy. That you go, exactly why are you thinking like this? You know, who put this in your head? You know, what deficiency in your day? What deficiency in your diet? What is it that's caused this? And I still struggle with that. And I remember when he was finished, I just looked at him and I go, you know, I got to tell you, if there was ever a guy who should not have a gun, it's you. This idea that the fantasy of taking someone's life, of putting yourself in that kind of danger. And now look, you know, I took private police training when I was a young man. The thought at some point I might want to be a policeman, and I didn't follow that path. But, you know, I took some of the training and I, you know, did the firearm stuff and all that. And one of the things that I absolutely remember is, you know, when you're doing the firearms training, is if you're going to pull it out, you better be willing to use it. Because at the time, now again, this is going back into the 90s, the early 90s, it was something like, you know, 60% of police officers killed in the line of duty are killed within 3 feet with their own weapon. So when you add a gun to the mix, things get more dangerous. And it makes sense. And the argument was, if you're going to pull it out, you better use it. And this is a person who, you know, sadly, had put so much time, energy, and fantasy into this. It was, my mind was like, you know, it's almost like he would encourage it. And this is the weird world that we're now kind of in, because I think back to that guy back then. To me, that was a red flag back then. And how many of the people who have gone and shot up, you know, gay nightclubs, or gone and shot up schools, how many people have had that kind of fetish fantasy? Now, I've asked a lot of my gun friends, have you ever had that thought? And everyone, yeah, you know,
somebody breaks in my house, I'm going to defend myself.
And you go, okay, I get that. You want to defend yourself and your family? Of course. Duh. But do you spend time, you know, fantasizing how you would do it? And, you know, where the gun would be? And it was again, the last person who should own a gun was that guy right there. So I look at this, and again, I come back to this moment where we hopefully begin to have some sanity. Nothing's going to happen for the next 2 years. We're here in Atlanta to try and get Reverend Warnock put back in the Senate. I think he's a good man. I think he's a decent man. I think he's an honest man. That, you know, to be honest, in this day and age is the best we're going to get out of some people. But he's somebody who is going to stand up for working people. Now, understand, you know, it's not going to matter. The Senate is already on the Democratic side. The House is going to be run by Republicans, which means nothing for the next 2 years will get done. It will be lots of fantasy, you know, hearings. There will be lots of, we're going to hear about Hunter Biden's laptop. But in the Senate, I want somebody who's going to be in there fighting for me. I want somebody who's going to be in there fighting for working people. And this is that kind of a moment. This is that kind of opportunity where, as a country, and I think the eyes of the country are on Georgia right now. What direction will they take? What path will they move? And this is kind of a moment for the country. Again, I come back to this because the choices could not be clearer. And yet, the polling that I'm seeing is way too close. There's all this report out there that, you know, it's, you know, voter apathy. Haven't seen that yet. I see people who are tired. I see people who are working way too hard. I see people who are working way too many hours and trying to figure out how they're going to fit this in. How are they going to fit in going to the polls and voting? And then the stories of these long lines, and, you know, it plays into the hey, just stay home. But these are the kind of elections where you can't stay home. And I'm hoping the people here in Georgia look on both sides. I want the true pulse of we the people. And I want everyone to have the opportunity freely and fairly to cast their ballot. Is that too much to ask? Now, we used to believe in those things. We did. We used to believe in those things at one point. I know I did. Still do. And yet here in this state, you know, one person can challenge thousands of ballots. One person can challenge thousands of people's ability to cast their ballot. It's insane to me. They've taken this runoff period from a 60-day runoff period down to a 30-day period. And in this truncated time frame, you know, the idea that you're going to be able to ramp up a get-out-the-vote operation, they don't want that. The fact that people are waiting in lines to put their ballots in a drop box because they've limited those numbers is insane to me. So for me, the idea is the rest of the country is watching. They're watching right now, and this could be, you know, look, if we get what I would argue to be the dumbest guy ever to serve in the U.S. Senate elected, we've got bigger problems than just one guy in the Senate. The message that's going to send, frightening. Frightening. But as always, I want to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I mean, this is one of those things that are just remarkable to me. Also, Twitter. Twitter is going to allow COVID misinformation. You know, we're going to have miracle cures. In fact, I'm getting stuff from Twitter all the time. I'm going, this is snake oil, but it's free under the guise of free speech. We're bringing free speech back, everybody. You're going to be able to say whatever you want. And what that really means is the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis and those folks, they're going to be able to use the N-word because it's what they really want. It's what gets them all, you know, tingly in the panties. They're going to be able to say mean things to people. without fear of being canceled. You can't cancel me. I'll call. And I go back to, you know, these are things that people say online that they would never say to someone in person. These are things that, quite frankly, it's one of those things my grandmother, my grandfather always said, never write something down you don't want your grandmother to read. You know, there's always a part of me. And maybe in your social media life, it's this as well. There's always a part of me that would want to send this stuff to their mother. Go, do you know what your son's doing? You know what your daughter's doing? Have you read this filth? And get those, you know, get mom to read mean tweets. I mean, seriously, I think that would be interesting. But, you know, my grandfather always said, never write anything down that you don't want your grandmother to hear or read. And that was always good advice. Now, also, don't say things that are going to get you beat up. Always good advice as well. But, you know, it's this moment that we find ourselves where we're the worst versions of ourselves online. We're the worst versions of ourselves when we think there's a bit of anonymity and no one can touch us or find us. So when someone like Elon Musk says, it's open season, I got a question. What's that going to mean? How bad will this be for working class people? Because ultimately, that's sadly who pays the price. It's the working people who pay the price in all of this. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Again, miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your podcast, you will find ours. Share with your friends, neighbors, coworkers. Get it out there. Also want to hear your thoughts. As I've said, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Eventually I get to them. So if you haven't heard from me yet, you will. But I appreciate you tuning in. We'll be back here in Atlanta tomorrow. And we'll see you then. Thanks so much for being here. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. At rick@therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's easy to lose sleep when you're worried about your health insurance plan. But when you have a family counting on you to take care of them, having the right coverage is more important than ever. That's why Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield is here to help. With low to no cost plans for you and your family, so you never go it alone. That's our anthem. Click to learn more.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.